So welcome all to the October meeting of the Ottawa PC User Group. If we have any guests with us tonight, welcome. We always welcome guests at any of our meetings. Feel free to join in anytime on any of our meetings. If you want to become a member, you can do so. It's at the top of the chat window, has the link where you can go to join the group. It's only $20 a year, and we'd be happy to expand our membership at any time. I think on the announcement side, just a reminder that we do have the elections coming up. So the nominations close at midnight, December 31st, and the email address to nominate yourself or somebody else is nominations@opcug.ca. It's published in the newsletter, and you can get that on our website. Or if for the future, you can get it delivered if you join the newsletter mailing list. I think that's all we've got for announcements. Just a reminder, I guess, that no Q&A tonight. We don't have Q&A on regular meeting nights. They will continue on other meeting nights, so next Wednesday will be the next formal Q&A session. And I would like to now turn it over to Lawrence, our program chair, to introduce tonight's speakers.
Hello, everyone. All right. Well, we're very glad to have Marie and Paul Middleveen to join us from Trailing Edge, a couple that have been running the business since 1997. And some of you may be familiar with Paul as doing the Tech Talk radio show on 580 CFRA. Yeah, I would also like to point out that here's a couple of business owners that are socially minded. I'm very impressed by their Facebook feed in that they post about such things as World Mental Health Day, Global Diversity Awareness, and, you know, they do their part to support other Bell Corners businesses. I get the feeling that the donut shop nearby gets a lot of business from either Paul or Maria, though they don't show it. And you know what? They are also community oriented, and they sponsor various local nonprofit organizations. And as well, they help the environment by doing their bit to sell refurbished equipment. With that all being said, I now pass it on to Paul and Maria to expand on their presentation today. Go ahead.
All right, thank you very much. We'll get our presentation slides up here shortly, and then we'll start. All right, does everybody see the main first slide?
Yep.
We're just looking for my silly notes. okay. It was working before. Sorry, guys. We had everything working last night when we were looking. So rather than having paper notes, I wanted to put all the notes right into the PowerPoint presentation. So they're all in there, but unfortunately, I just can't see them.
If you go to the slideshow menu, you should be able to set it up for, you've got a presenter view. Yeah.
And last night it was wonderful. We had our notes all on the one side, slide.
And now my mouse isn't working.
Well, we'll just go by the slides.
Yeah.
I don't need no notes.
There you go.
Thanks for your patience, everybody. And hello and welcome to the OPCUG, three-letter acronym, lots of fun stuff, Ottawa PC Users Group general hardware meeting with us from the Trailing Edge. Thank you so much for having us and really appreciate it. So overall today we're going to be talking about differences between various processors. Mainly we're focusing on the Intel processor, since there is quite a variety out there. And also RAM, what is it, how much do I need? Do I need a lot? And then also, what is the difference between a HDD and SDD, your storage devices, a hard disk drive or the solid state drive? Also, what do I need in a video card, or do I even need, say, a dedicated video card for what I may be using my computer for? And of course, we always want to know, what do we need on our device to hook up all our other devices? So what ports are available? Are you thinking of, you know, getting a particular piece of hardware that uses maybe a proprietary port? And just to make sure that you're looking for that on the PC that you'd like to purchase or notebook you'd like to get in the future. And then towards the end there, we're going to compare two new laptops, and we're also going to compare a new and a used laptop, sort of to see, you know, what you're getting there and, you know, what you're getting for your dollar and where the savings could be. So next slide. So essentially, nowadays, everything is always getting more sophisticated, so it's a hard thing to be able to figure out what you're looking for. With the Intel processors, the most familiar thing I think people have heard in ads and when they go into stores is the i-series processors. So they've been around for about 13 years, 14 years now. And these processors, essentially you can think of them as stepping stones, i3 being your more of your entry level or basic need CPU, and the i5 being a mid-range to possibly a little bit higher ends for somebody that's maybe doing a little bit more work. And then the i7, which tends to be, you know, the upper echelon of all processors. So what should you be looking for when you're looking at your CPUs? Well, the major one nowadays is core counts. Back in the day, you used to have one processor and it was just a processor that was processing your information. And now they've been working around getting multiple CPUs on one processor die or core. So you can have several processors doing the work for you rather than just the one. And you've probably heard the term hyper-threading. If you haven't, it's again when the World Wide Web started taking off and everybody's using single core processors and the computer could only really do, you know, lots of stuff but one thing at a time. That's when the evolution of having multi-core processors started to occur. So you want to have a good core count, especially if you're going to be doing more work or having more web pages open. So that's one thing I would ask if you're going in to talk to somebody about your new computer or notebook purchase. So how many cores does this computer have? And then on top of how many cores does it have? Because again, there are other features in the processor that can make it faster or slower. Another one is clock speed. So if you are using a lighter weight i5 or i3, you find out how many cores you have. Two, how fast are those cores working? Because again, you may have a i3 dual core, but it's running at 4 gigahertz, and then you have an i5 dual core, and it might only be running at 2 or 1.7 because it's a lower power consumption model. So even though it has a higher number, it doesn't necessarily mean it's faster than the i3 in this particular example. The other thing as well, when I was talking about thread counts, is that now they have multi-threaded processors and in the sense that each core, besides getting one job, now they can do two jobs or handle multiple threads or, information that needs to process at once. So it can get quite confusing, but if you take all three of these numbers, you have a good idea of how fast each core is working, how many cores you have working for you doing your various paperwork or jobs or photo editing, and then also, does it have a multi-thread capability? Because there are CPUs out there that can handle multiple threads per core and others that don't. And this can make quite a big difference on your performance. Next slide, please. So next, of course, you know about your CPU. Now you're thinking about, well, you know, like everybody's throwing all these numbers at me. And of course, the higher the number it is, usually the better better it is for you, but it's sort of like saying, do I need a Lamborghini to drive to the grocery store? It may feel real nice. It may go real fast, but you probably don't need it. And most of us that are budget conscious don't necessarily want to be paying for something that we're not going to use. So with Windows and how it's evolved over the years, and most of us are using Windows 10, when it first came out, I mean, you could even use it with 1 gig of RAM and 2 gigs was recommended. And now the minimum is basically 4 gigabytes of RAM. The Windows operating system itself, it tends to use about 3 to 4 gigs of RAM, depending on the computer and chipsets and a whole bunch of other things. But on average, about 3 to 4 gigs of RAM is dedicated or wants to be used by the operating system. So if you don't have that RAM, like I would recommend getting 8 gigabytes of RAM. Most people out there doing their common to day-to-day tasks with their PC, 8 gigs will make the computer run smoother and more effectively, because your RAM is sort of like your workspace or your desktop. So if you're sitting there working on a whole bunch of pieces of paper and you have to spread them out over your desk, you can only fit so many there. It's just like your RAM. Windows is trying to do stuff, but it can only use so much because there's only so much space. And same with all the other programs you have. So if you don't have enough memory, it makes things start doing what they call swapping. So it's swapping from your storage device, your hard drive or your solid state drive, and buffering it and putting it into RAM, and then the computer processor is processing the information. So again, it is nice to have more RAM. Most people can get away with having 8 to 16 gigs of RAM. 8 for most people, 16 if you're a little bit more of a power user. And if you're over 16 gigs of RAM, it's usually because you're doing a little bit more of a niche thing. Like not everybody does video editing, not everybody games, and not everyone's an architect trying to redesign things or figure out what the new COVID molecule looks like by doing distributed processing. So
crunching the numbers for the Big Bang Theory.
Yeah, exactly. So again, keep that in mind. But for most enthusiasts out there that are perhaps doing that heavier duty stuff, you might jump up to 32 or 64 gigs of RAM. After that, you're getting into some pretty specialized hardware, in which case you definitely want to come talk to a professional. So next small topic here is hard drives and hard disk drive and a solid state drive. And essentially, what's the difference between these two? Why should I get a solid state? Solid state drives, again, have been evolving very nicely over the last 20 years. I'd say over the last decade, they've definitely pushed their way into the mainstream market. So much so now, I would prefer every computer came with a solid state and never came with a hard disk drive unless it was for extra data storage. Reasons for this, I had a customer come to me about 2 months ago. They bought a brand new system online from Dell. Nothing wrong with the computer, beautiful computer, i5, 10th gen, 16 gigs of RAM. But it had, he bought it brand new with a mechanical 1 terabyte drive as the main operating system drive. Also, a hard disk drive, if you're not aware, is essentially like the picture you see there. It's like a record, similar to a record. If you're spinning this device, and in many cases they're spinning at 5,000 to 7,000 RPM, and then it has an actuator arm and a read-write head, just like a record player has a needle to read the data. So this takes energy, takes time, and also it limits how fast you can access your data. So a solid-state drive essentially has no moving parts. It's all, silicone and chipsets, and you're moving around electrons. So it's as fast as you can make the interface for the drive or the technology that they've built into the circuitry. And they've been improving that very much as well. As an example, your hard disk drives back in the day, they barely read a meg or two a second, if that. I could pull up some numbers for you, but I don't know off the top of my head at the moment. But your SATA hard disk drives, that people are probably familiar with that term, serial ATA hard drives, they typically ran between possibly bursting from 100 megabytes to maybe up to 300 megabytes per second, but typically your transfer speed would be around 50 megs a second. And what does this mean? Well, if you wanted to be playing that high def movie that you're watching off of your hard drive, old technology just wouldn't be able to do it. It wasn't fast enough per se. But also response time. We all want everything done quickly. Well, a solid state drive on the same SATA interface that would be on your computer or your notebook, it runs about 4 to 5 times faster than a mechanical. So instead of getting, say, you know, those bursts of 100, 150, maybe a little more in terms of accessing your data, your solid state drives can do most commonly between 400 and about 550 megs a second. So that's going to make your system boot up quicker, be more responsive, and when you're opening up your documents or show or whatnot, launching that computer program, it's just going to come up that much faster. And we all would prefer to save a few minutes these days.
We're all pretty spoiled these days.
Yeah, very much so.
Yeah.
And in the newer technology on solid state drives, you might have heard of M.2 SATA slots or NVMe. And essentially, this is talking directly to the PCI Express bus. So essentially, it's talking to a bigger section of the highway on your computer. Because the closer you get to the processor, the bigger the highway gets. And you want to have the widest and biggest amount of space you have to be able to put all this data in and out of these devices.
And not that it's all that important, because you really shouldn't be dropping your computer anyways, but
yeah.
I believe an SSD is quite a bit, like it can handle, you know, a bit more wear and tear. It
can definitely handle drops and bumps and bangs way better, especially for us carrying notebooks around and we accidentally drop it.
Oopsie.
Even if the laptop breaks, typically your data is safe on your SSD drive. You'd have to throw it around pretty hard to put a microfracture in the board that's on there. And also these NVMe drives, just to give your mind a little bit of a bang. I was talking about, you know, the older drives doing anywhere from, say, 30 megs up to 300 megs, and that's bursting speeds. The newer NVMe's, if you're going with, say, a performance series, the standard NVMe's are doing anywhere from 1500 to about 2800 megs a second. And remember, I just said a SATA solid state drive does around 400 to 500. So think of how much faster that is now. And the performance ones, you're getting read and write speeds in the 7,000 range. So again, if you need it, it's out there. It does cost more money. It is newer technology, but wow, is it ever just amazing how fast we're changing.
Yeah.
So next on the list, of course, is what do I need in a video card? Again, it depends on what you're using the system for, but also what you're connecting it to. So you might have a monitor at home and you're just buying a new PC and still using your older monitor if it works well. So a very common port is a VGA port. This has been around for, again, 2 decades plus. A lot of systems still have that and a lot of monitors. So that would be a common one. The ones that we're seeing these days that are the most common would be HDMI and DisplayPort. Both of those pass audio and video through. Also, you know, handle various forms of resolution and data transmission. So for most people, a standard cable is just fine. But keep in mind, if you're trying to run a 4K monitor or an 8K monitor, you do need to check to see what revisions you have on those cables that you might be purchasing. Because some of them may not be able to handle the higher resolutions. They do need a better quality cable to be able to handle that, again, data being transferred to and from the monitor. Also, you can get HDMI and mini HDMI, DisplayPort as well, mini DisplayPort. You'll see those ports more so on tablets and notebooks. But a lot of video cards that are designed to do multiple monitor layouts, you know, the guys that do, say, stock trading and things like that, they might want to run 4 or 8 monitors. So in many cases, you'll see like an NVIDIA Quattro series card with a whole bunch of mini display ports on it. And back in the day, the DVI would be sort of the predecessor to this stuff with the digital signal. And they had a whole bunch of those too. But keep in mind, whatever monitor you have or TV you have, check what ports you have on that, what resolution it supports, and perhaps refresh rates. And whatever cable you're going to buy, just ask those questions. Does this support this particular resolution? Is this cable capable of doing 60 hertz or 120 hertz, whatever your requirement would be?
So Lawrence is asking a question. What's the practical difference between an HDMI and display port connector?
The practical?
I think it depends on what the monitor comes with. Because I remember the monitors that I have upstairs, it was only display port, because we couldn't use HDMI on them.
Well, both blast video and audio through. HDMI came out first overall in terms of the market taking them over. DisplayPort, you do need to be careful with. HDMIs, they don't have a latching system on them, so you can easily insert and remove the cable. But DisplayPorts, I'd say 80%, 90% of the adapters or cables that you get, they do have a little latching system, so you got to make sure you press that down. I've seen many people remove them directly out of the computer. They both can do very similar qualities in terms of refresh rates and resolutions. But maybe I need to find out a little bit more information from you on the question.
I actually had a little bit of a follow-up to that myself. I mean, if you had both HDMI and DisplayPort, both on the computer and the monitor, is there any reason why you would pick one over the other, and which would you pick?
Good follow-up, Chris. Yes.
Well, in a sense, sort of what I was mentioning when I was discussing it, the ports that are on your computer and or on the monitor that you're using may be of a certain revision. So if your computer had HDMI 1 and a DisplayPort 1.2, the DisplayPort 1.2 spec supports a higher resolution or higher refresh rates. Mm-hmm. So it may come down to what port you have, and does one provide a better color depth or better refresh rate supported by that cable. Because you may hook it up, it may work fine, but you may get better picture quality or better, stable display or image with that higher quality cable or higher revision cable or port.
Is there a practical limit to the number of ports? I don't think I've ever seen more than two HDMI ports, but I have seen cards with like four display ports on it.
Yes. Is there a limit? Well, I've brought in some that have breakout cables. So it'll have, say, four ports on the back, and then each port can turn into two ports. So all of a sudden you can have eight monitors running.
Like screens all around you.
Tons and tons of screens. we've done that for some schools. Again, we've done that for stock traders as well.
Yes.
Doctor's offices, when they want to have the same image coming from their server on multiple screens, and they just want them to display everywhere. So, it depends on what you're doing. I've never really looked to see what video card would have the most ports available, but definitely I've done up to eight monitor outputs. The other thing, too, when it comes to DisplayPort in particular, some of the NVIDIA cards, depending on what resolutions you're supporting, you would need to use two ports. Like, one port will do 4K, but if you want to run a 4K monitor, you actually have to use their cable that now combines two ports into one, allowing it to do a full 8K on that one display. So, to say, the tough part is knowing your knowledge, and if you don't know, finding somebody, a friend, family member, somebody at a store that you can trust, and throw your questions at. And honestly, if I don't know the answer, I'll certainly try and find out for you. So.
Yeah, just a side note, I figured out how to get to presenter view. There was a few buttons on the bottom of the presentation, wanted to know.
So. Yeah, we probably clicked them off earlier by mistake.
So. Yeah.
All right, so essentially we've been talking about the ports on a GPU, your graphic processing unit. Most computers, they have a graphics card in on them. They're just what's called an integrated graphic card. So it's built into the CPU and in conjunction with the motherboard as well. So you need to, if you're building a custom computer, you really got to know your stuff, because you might buy a processor that doesn't have graphic capability and a board that does, and you're wondering why you're getting no signal out on your monitor. We've had a lot of new beginner gamer builders, or people that just are enthusiasts like yourselves and they want to build a PC. That would be one of those things where you can make a mistake where you didn't get the right CPU to have that graphic support. And again, for most basic stuff, surfing the web, you know, watching YouTube videos, Word documents, all your basic needs of a computer, you don't need to have a dedicated card. Your integrated cards essentially have plenty of horsepower, and plus they borrow usually system memory, so that RAM we were talking about when we were thinking about, do I need 8 or 16 gigs of RAM? Depending on what you're doing, it might be nice to have that little bit of extra RAM there to support the video card, because it'll borrow whatever it can take until it can't take any more. So like I was saying, with Windows 10 using 4 gigs of RAM, it might only use 2 to 3 when it only has 4, but it's always swapping information in and out. If you had 8, it'll use 4, and you'll still have 4 left for other applications. If you had 16 and you have your integrated card, again, to optimize or tweak that integrated video card, many times there's settings in your BIOS, where you can say, only borrow this a certain amount of RAM, or borrow more. You know, share your video memory or don't share your video memory. So there are possibly some options there to make the cards quicker and better. But as I said, you have 16 gigs of RAM, the OS is using 4, some applications might be using 4, your video card might borrow 1 to 7 of the rest of the memory that's there to make it perform a little better. And then, like we were saying, we talked about all the various video ports. So again, it just depends on how many monitors you want to run. And then, of course, usually higher end video cards or GPUs, it's a card that can be added to your PC. It's using an expansion slot. In many cases, a lot of these cards will require extra power, so you could run into problems adding a video card on a pre-built machine, because a lot of these higher end cards that have that extra processing power to render videos and do all this extra fun stuff also require extra current or power to the video card itself. So they'll have connectors and your power supply might just not have enough power to do it. And then you got to try and change that part out too. And doing all this horsepower, in many cases, a lot of people wonder about, do I need a fan? How many fans should I get? Honestly, every card is a little different. You can get the exact same chipset for a video card from NVIDIA or whoever your favorite video card manufacturer is. And one will be a silent edition, you know, with a larger fan that runs at a lower RPM. If noise is a big concern in the office environment or home that you're in. But again, the higher the horsepower of the card, typically the more chance it requires 1 to 2 fans, maybe even 3, just to keep it running at an optimal temperature. Because as you're working these cards, if you don't have the proper cooling, or you turn, in some cases, customize your fan speed settings, it could be raising the temperature of your video card to the point where it could possibly fail. So if you don't mind a little bit of noise, well, as many fans as you can, but they can only fit so many on there. So I'd say most are going to come with 1 to 3.
We've got a couple of questions here, Paul.
Awesome.
Recently, how many monitors would you suggest the average desktop user should have? It's from Bob.
I mean, again, it's a little bit of a personal choice, but I personally like using 2 when I can. Usually, like, I have my primary screen where I may be doing some work, or if you're doing research on stuff, so you can have your primary screen where you're doing your work and editing, and your secondary screen where you're doing your research, or your email open on one screen and web pages open on another screen. Just, you know, it makes it a little easier to function. It's nice to have the extra space. So I'd say most people can use 1 to 2, but if we start falling in love with having more than one monitor, hey, maybe three or four.
And as a follow-up from Harvey, recently seen a 34-inch monitor that can be partitioned up to four displays on the monitor. That's fun.
Yes. It certainly is a nice feature, especially when it's a really big monitor. But most of us are probably have a, on the small side, a 19. Mm-hmm. Probably we all of us on average might have a 22-inch monitor. That's pretty common in the industry. And I must say it is nice to have a second monitor for sure.
And then Mark, not every HDMI connection is the same. HDCP HDMI cable has built-in digital content protection, whatever that is.
So HDCP essentially is, of course, now I forgot the four-letter acronym, but it's essentially copyright protection in a sense. They don't want people pirating shows and or movies or streaming something that's coming from a paid source. So you have to have a video card that's HDCP compliant and a cable and or a monitor, because it'll just tell you that you can't display this information.
And I used to go multi-monitor and at one point had three, and I discovered the joy of having a single very big 4K monitor and just go with the one monitor. At 4K, you can have lots of windows on screen, all partitioned up using PowerToy Fancy Zones. Yeah,
PowerToys, that's a pretty cool place to check out. Now, I love the higher resolution monitors, especially for obviously watching or looking at pictures. The detail is just gorgeous as long as the picture and or show you're watching is also in the same resolution. But me with my eyesight, even with a big 4K display, when you're breaking a 4K down, in a sense, it's sort of like having four 1080p monitors there. But I still find even on a 32, when I'm breaking them down into windows, I'm putting on my glasses and staring at that screen. So I just like having a nice big screen or two big screens in front of me.
And just because there's another question coming up, but I don't want to leave anyone out. Alan, if you have a small laptop, a large secondary monitor is really nice. I agree completely.
100%.
Chris, benefit of a single big high resolution, or rather multi-monitor, is for those cases when you want to use all the disk real estate for one program. I agree.
Oh, and I want to answer this one from Bill. Does your computer run cooler with an SD? 100% yes. Your mechanical drives are making heat from spinning and being a physical system that's working, but also, they're consuming more power. It's producing heat, so your mechanical drives definitely run warmer in your desktops and notebooks. The SSDs, of course, are still producing heat, and I can certainly look up some statistics for you and provide that to you at a later date. I just don't have it off the top of my head what the averages would be temperature-wise.
Okay, so the next one. Here we go.
Video cards and all this darn ports. Now, what about all these other ports? Again, the most common one that we all are familiar with is USB, Universal Serial Bus. The most common plug-in is a Type A, which is a rectangular port with a little piece of plastic inside. You can use many peripherals. Essentially, USB sort of got us away from using the old, 9-pin, 25-pin serial parallel communication ports. So your printers, your keyboards, your mice, your headsets, video cards. Even if your computer can't, say, have a video card added to it, in many cases you could plug in a USB device that is a little graphics card in itself with a port on the end. So you don't have an output on your computer, or it can't handle having a big video card put in, and you mainly want to have an extra display. These devices run anywhere from about $40 to hundreds of dollars, but the average about $40 to $100. And if you get a USB to VGA, DVI, HDMI display port to have that secondary monitor. So most computers nowadays that you're going to see in the market are going to be, you're going to be seeing the Type A and the newer Type C port. I do like the Type C, faster data transmission, but also the universal port. You can plug the cable in both ways, so you don't have to be looking at it or wondering if you're going to break the piece of plastic on your USB port. So definitely a nicer port style. And in many cases, your USB Type-C, you do have to check your computer. But as I was saying, the USB Type-A's, you can get one that sort of has an external video card on it. You can just get a cable that has VGA, HDMI, or DisplayPort, et cetera, off of it, and they'll cost you about $20 or so, $20 to $30 for a cable that will allow you to have a video output. But that's only on the USB Type-Cs, and not all Type-Cs do that. Some of them are considered just a data port, so keep that in mind when you're purchasing a computer as well, if you plan on running a monitor off of your USB Type-C port.
And if you're feeling really nostalgic and you want to build something from way back when, come visit us because we have every USB or cable imaginable. I mean, yeah.
Yeah, we get people coming in that are making older computers to play arcade systems. So they'll buy a PROM or a device that has 50, 60 different arcade games on it, and they'll build a nostalgic box that looks like an arcade box, put in a CRT monitor, and it's all just being run on a regular little PC.
So I love this. We're not even needed. So Jocelyn asked which USB port Europe adopted to power devices, and Timothy answered
I was going to say Type-C,
so that's great.
Oh, good. There you go.
And then me and Chris are having a conversation about wonderful big monitors, so that's great. And then Bill, what is the FirePort only associated with Apple?
The FireWire port was available, I can still get in cards and components for it. Definitely one of those interface types that was, I guess, sort of, what's going to be adopted more, USB or FireWire. And FireWire was definitely more on the Mac side. But it was very popular with video editing and on your cameras and other devices. And again, Apple, I find in many cases, is also more in the professional market for doing your video editing and photography work. Not so much now, but say 10 to 20 years ago, Apple definitely was predominant there. They had faster speeds in many cases than USB at the time. But now with USB 3, it's definitely faster and a better use. The next port is the Ethernet port. Most computers, again, will have this. A lot of your newer notebooks and some desktops will not. But this is so you can hardwire your computer in to get your internet connection or your home network, like your home group of PCs working together. I do like Ethernet because I do, people can hack into your network, but people can usually hack into your wireless network easier. Most of us, if we have the time and patience, we could probably go online and literally find a hacker's website that will provide us with software to hack into wireless networks. So again, Ethernet's just a good option to have in case your wireless goes down for some reason. And also a little more secure and more stable of a connection. So depending on what's happening in your area, something could affect the wireless signal and it might be dropping or running at a lower speed. And of course, we all want to hear each other and listen to sounds and whatnot. So whatever type of audio device you might be using, a lot of them, as I say, are USB connections, but most computers will have the little 3.5 millimeter combo jack or a separate headphone and audio jack. So just to see if it's on the computer if you need it.
And then Chris is asking, isn't FireWire just IEEE 1394 in the PC world, or are there differences?
No, IEEE 1394 is FireWire.
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely, in the PC world. But it is called FireWire. The IEEE 1394 on the Apple side, I mean, I thought it was the same thing, but I could be 100% wrong. I'm more than willing to admit that.
Can you tell we're PC people? No.
Yes, honestly, I've hardly dealt in Mac Apple product at all.
I like your phones.
Yeah.
Anywho, sorry, I digress.
So when we were talking about all these various components, the processor, the RAM, the hard drive, all that good stuff, Just wanted to quickly compare two machines that I have in stock at the moment. So both of these are new. Both of them are from Lenovo. One's a, you know, a good entry level business class i3 10th generation, 8 gig 256. Again, great for all your everyday needs. For most people's general use, one of these types of machines would be suffice. The regular price on one of these, they can range anywhere from being on super special, maybe down to, you know, $450-$500, but rarely there at the moment. But they can go as high as about $700 to $800 for an i3 as well, depending on screen sizes and stuff. The second one is one of the flagship Ultra notebooks from Lenovo. So it's an X1. We didn't put the word carbon, but it's an X1 Carbon Extreme. So essentially, they're built for, they're lightweight, they're build strength and quality. They're using carbon fiber throughout the unit. It also has a much faster processor with an i7 11th gen. So the i3 is a dual core in this one, the 10th gen, and the i7 is an 8 core 16 thread. And of course you can get bigger, better, faster than that, but it also has the 16 gigs of RAM, so double the memory, but like we're saying, you can increase that. But the RAM, you know, between these two machines, the things I don't have up there are the questions that I want you to be able to think about asking. How many cores does it have? So as I say, don't go by, oh, this is an i7, it's awesome and wonderful. Or this has 16 gigs of RAM, so it must be great. Or a big hard drive, a terabyte storage, so it must be good. It's the finer details, such as, you know, is it a solid state or a mechanical? How fast is each thing running, or how many cores does it have? So I sort of left those out on purpose. the X1 Extreme there, it also has a dedicated 6 gigabyte video card that you could easily do gaming and video editing on. A 3060, I would say, is sort of your mainstream gaming and video editing card right now before it starts getting ridiculously priced. So a 3060, you could probably find them as low as about 400, and they can go as high as around 900, the average being about 500-600 for the 3060 video card just on its own. And the X1 Extreme, although I have it on sale for $26.99, Lenovo was running a special on these. The original price on this is $3,200. So again, do you need the Lamborghini? Probably not. So keep that in mind when you're hearing all these buzzwords and whatnot. And then we'll just go to the next slide.
Yeah, we see that we have some questions. We just want to get through the next slide if I can. But now that I've done this, gosh, I just want to get off that. Can I do that? There we go.
All right, so here we have a brand new Lenovo and a refurbished or off-lease Dell. So one thing to point out with Windows on its latest revision of its operating system, they came out with Windows 11 last year in October, and you can still use Windows 10 till 2025 October. They're not going to stop supporting it. But your Windows 11, this is the first time Microsoft has put a hardware requirement to use the OS. I mean, we always had our minimums, you know, I need so much RAM, so much CPU or whatever, but put it on your machine and it should run. And if it doesn't, maybe you just need to change that one part and hopefully you can get a driver for it. Well, now you must have an Intel Core i-series that is 8th generation or better. So essentially, they're chopping off a huge section of the market, and to me, I find it sort of silly. If the older generation system will run the operating system, don't force people to upgrade their hardware. To me, it's just a grab at making consumers consume more. You can actually load Windows 11 on older machines, and we've done it. We've even put it on really old dual cores. That are, you know, in the 12-year range. It'll run fairly slow, but it at least works. So the reason I put the used Dell up there is because it does have an 8th generation i5 with 4 cores. The top one, the 11th gen with four cores as well. So they both have the same number of cores. The Dell has a slightly less base clock speed. And they have made some improvements between the 8th generation and the 11th generation of the i5. So it does benchmark a little faster. But as, again, as far as the end user is concerned, the i5 8th gen is a Windows 11 ready machine that will definitely do all your basic needs, including going more into a little bit higher end work. And we also provide a 3-year warranty on this one at a cost of around $650. And the new one comes with a 1-year warranty at about $1,100. So RAM, same amount of RAM, it's going to be working fine there. Both of them have NVMe solid state drives, so really quick data access there. The main limitation overall is the CPU, but again, they both have four cores, both can handle 8 threads, so they both can handle 8 tasks at once. Just the Dell will do it a little bit slower, but you're also saving yourself hundreds of dollars and getting 2 more years on the warranty. So just try and balance that out. So overall, light duty stuff, which honestly is what we're all using our computers for mainly, just a good quality, a system with, I would say, 8 gigs of RAM and a solid state drive are the two main things you're looking for. For heavy duty, of course, you're probably going to want to jump more into the i7s, even the i9s that they have out there right now. And I would say in the 16 to 32 gigs of RAM, because you're doing all that extra work, you need to have that extra space for your shared integrated video card or for the applications to be loading those larger files of data sets you're working on. And a refurbished product can be just as good as new. Typically, your refurbished products as well are corporate models. So most of the models I sell, 95% plus of all the computer notebooks and tablets that I sell that are off-lease are all a corporate-built machine. So essentially, they don't want these machines to break. They don't want to send technicians out to fix them, where a consumer machine, they're not building them to fail, but they're not using as good quality components or as maybe not as many layers on the motherboard to help with heat dissipation, flexibility and strength in the boards and parts. Also, the plastics that they're using on them in many cases, depending on what resins are being used, that piece of plastic might last a couple of years before fading and being prone to taking chips and cracks versus, 8, 10, 15 years down the road. So we may be paying more for some things when they're brand new, but when they're off lease, you do have that factor in there as well, that they're built better than a consumer product.
And I think we've got some questions.
And now we can get to answering all the questions. I hope I didn't ramble too much. And as I say, some of this stuff you can get really in-depth on. So I was just trying to give a very broad view on the basics that you should be thinking about for your computer. So let's see.
And we really want to thank Lawrence and Chris for letting us present to you today. We used to love doing the radio show, and this is kind of a little nostalgic for us to be able to do something for the community.
Yeah.
And hopefully we gave you some new information. But I can go to the chat, Chris, if you'd like, or what would you like me to do?
Yeah, first off, thanks very much. And that's great. What I'm going to do now is I can't force unmute. So all I can do is I can mute all and give people the ability to unmute themselves, which will include you, and Balt. You'll have to unmute yourself again. So I guess right now I would open it up to anybody who wants to ask questions. You can either unmute yourself at this point or you can continue using the chat. Just to kick things off, I noted on the last slide you had, you didn't list the Core i5. And I've always sort of looked at a Core i5 as being a really good middle-of-the-road sort of level rather than going to the bottom of the heap with the Core i3. What's your thought on the Core i5?
Oh, no, I do like it. I just sort of wanted to give the bottom and top end of the spectrum there.
Okay.
And the sense of I find when I shop, and you're talking to a salesperson, usually they're trying to sell you whatever the special of the week is.
Okay.
Or they'll just you know, they're trying to get their numbers. When you go into a computer store, a lot of these places may be on commission. I base the way we work at our store on what are your needs and what are your wants. So let's get you what you need, and if you do want this, let's talk about it and figure out what you really want, and try and get you the best machine for the money. I don't feel you should spend money just because you have money or because somebody says you need it. I'd rather have someone be very happy with the product they have and also feel good about what they spent and why they spent it. So, again, I love big shiny things. I love the greatest hardware. You know, I have a gaming rig myself, but I put restrictions and budgets on myself for when I'm buying it because I'm just doing it as an enthusiast. But if I was using this to render AutoCAD designs and drawings, well, I might have increased my video card budget by double. You know, and like you said, the i5 processor, I should have mentioned that as well. It is sort of the good mid-range to go. Like if you're a little bit unsure, jump into the i5. It's going to last longer. Like the faster you buy now, the longer typically it will last as you're using it. So yeah, there is that as well. You got to weigh these pros and cons, and that's what we're there for.
They were recommending it, actually. Carleton University, the engineering program, was recommending an i5 for their students. So,
funnily enough, i5 fourth generation or higher. And a quad core i5 as well, because there's a bunch of dual cores out there. So they were recommending a minimum of an i5 fourth gen with 8 gigs of RAM and a solid state drive for their basic computer work. But again, as I say, it really depends on what you plan on using that computer for, because some of them are doing much more sophisticated work and need to have those capabilities looked at.
Right. Natalie has an interesting question. I definitely have my opinion on it, but I'll let you guys field it. She says, I have both a hard disk drive and a solid state drive. The operating system is on the hard disk drive. Would it be better to have everything on the solid state drive for longevity, heat, et cetera? And if that's the case, would only the solid state drive be in use?
Honestly, I would much rather have my operating system on the solid state rather than the other way around, 100%. I'm looking at that going, that is your major bottleneck in your computer right now.
Yeah, that's the problem.
Yeah. So if you did transfer it, again, it all deals with how big is the solid state and how big is your mechanical. How much data do you have on it and will it move over? Because you can do something called cloning. Sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't. Sometimes you got to run some repair utilities on the operating system or file structure, because there could be problems you're unaware of, and usually you find them when you're doing what's called a clone. definitely, if you're willing to, perhaps get that switched around, get your operating system on the SSD. Because there alone, even if it's a SATA SSD, you're going to be running 3 to 4 times quicker in terms of how fast the computer boots up. So a good question would be, how fast do you find your computer's working right now in terms of its boot up time? If it's taking a couple of minutes or several minutes and you switched over to that SSD, it'll probably be coming up in about 10 to 40 seconds rather than, you know, 2 to 10 minutes. So I hope I answered the question.
Yeah, and so did Alan, by the way. Good job. That's great.
Yeah. I think Jocelyn has an interesting follow-up, which may be beyond what can really be covered right here, is what is involved to transfer the operating system from, in Natalie's case, the hard disk drive, getting it over onto the SSD.
Well, the good thing is that it's on the same computer. So when you're cloning from one computer to another, think of computers as people in a sense. We're all different. All the computers are unique. So every component that's in there needs to have a piece of software that's helping run that hardware. So we can clone it to another hard drive and put it in another computer, and that's where you may run into more issues as well when it comes to the drivers or hardware side. You might get lots of blue screens and you may be able to repair those. But in your case, your operating system is on the computer you want to use it on. and it's just on a mechanical. So again, if we move it over to the SSD, that should be the least amount of problems in terms of transferring the OS using the cloning procedure. Otherwise, you could reload, like format your SSD and just load Windows onto it, leave the other hard drive in there. So there's many different ways you can do it, but one thing to check out, if you know the brand name of the hard drives that are in your computer, many of them may offer free cloning software. Like Western Digital and I believe Seagate are offering a sort of a lightweight version of Acronis, I believe, or at least they used to, that if you had one of their hard drives, you could use this software and do the clone yourself, so you didn't have to buy the software.
Yeah.
That's a nice little perk.
Does that answer your question, Jocelyn, or kind of? Oh, here we go. We've got numbers here from Natalie, 1 terabyte.
And a 256.
And a 256. I think it should be fine.
Well, again, if your OS is on the 1 terabyte and you have over 256 gigs of data, it won't go onto the SSD.
Yeah, that's when you get into having to shuffle things around to make things fit. I mean, that to me, though, is an ideal setup for having the OS booting off the SSD, and you can have all your programs there nice and easy, and then put basically all your data onto the terabyte hard drive, and that will get you nice performance, but lots of room for data and so forth. But yeah, if you've got more than 256 gigs already on the 1 terabyte hard drive, it gets to be a little trickier to actually swap things around.
Yeah, because there's no way we can transfer it the way it is, but maybe we can move all your pictures off. Like if you have an external backup drive, move your pictures and move your data off of it at that time. We can do the clone then when it's smaller, and we can do this for you too. And then once the clone's been done and the 1 terabyte is available, then all that data can be put back onto the 1 terabyte. The other cool and nice thing that you can do with Windows, especially when you're doing combination drives like this, where you have the SSDs, but you want to have the affordability of the hard disk drive for larger storage of movies and pictures and everything else that we like. Where was it going?
I'm looking at the chat trying to decipher which one we should go with next, but
Paul, are you thinking about the location?
Is that
what you're thinking about?
That's exactly it. Yes.
Thanks, Harvey.
You're welcome.
You can just go right into your computer settings, and rather than the music file being stored in your users folder on your C drive or your solid state drive, and you have this other hard disk, you can make your own folder on the other drive, and you can have it dump data there, but you can also have it move all the data over to the other hard drive as well, which is a really nice feature. You got, 50 gigs of photos on yours, you add another hard drive to it, you've told it that that's where you want your pictures folder to be, and then you can actually tell it to move everything over there as well. So if some of you didn't know that, that's a neat little feature if you do that.
Hey, here's a plug for the Trailing Edge. Alan's asking, does the Trailing Edge have a service department? If so, are the main problems hardware or software related? What are the main problems that people bring to your store, and could these be avoided through better usage practices?
Most definitely.
We have a service department. Yeppers.
So we do take care of hardware and software problems, diagnosing your equipment, testing, your hardware, all the various components. A lot of systems like Dell or HP may even have a diagnostic built into the BIOS to do some basic testing. Windows has some basic testing built in for hard drives and RAM as well. But we will test all your hardware and see what perhaps is failing or not, and also check your Windows operating system, vent viewer logs. We can certainly take care of all of those issues.
And it's one of the reasons why we're starting to write a blog on our website to try to get people learning about phishing emails and other issues that can plague a machine. And, you know, if people just knew, they wouldn't click on those links, or they wouldn't, you know, they wouldn't use their machines in not the best way. So.
Yeah, in many cases, you don't even know you're going onto a website that might have malware on it. They can look very official.
Oh, yeah.
We've probably all seen the emails from Bell.
Canada Post?
You know,
oh,
Canada
my gosh.
Post,
like, it looks so real. That's incredible.
And they're just screen scraping, you know, GIFs and pictures and whatnot and making it look like their own. But in our service department, I would say it's really hard to say, you know, that it's a 50-50 hardware-software thing. But it does feel like that. you know, anything from a power supply failing, a stick of RAM having some bad blocks in it, so your computer still runs, but every now and then it tends to glitch or possibly reboot or possibly do a blue screen. So that can, and it can come from so many different things. So unfortunately, that's why you got to test all of that.
Talking about failure rates, going back to hard disk drives versus solid-state drives, do you notice, like, are SSDs lasting longer than hard disk drives or shorter? And do they fail in the same way in that, you know, is it catastrophic, all of a sudden, bang, it's gone, or a slow failure over time that you can actually react to? What are your thoughts on the one technology versus the other?
Well, when solid states first came out, honestly, not very reliable, and failure rates I saw all over the place. Like, again, I've been doing computer sales and playing with computers since I was about 4 years old. I started doing, you know, retail stuff when I was in high school, just like some of the guys I have in my shop, we've done co-ops with. I started doing a co-op in a local computer store and have been doing it ever since. So, I've definitely seen solid-state drives that were, to me, didn't even want to touch the technology when it was first really coming out into the mainstream. But I would say about 10 years after they were making it mainstream, you know, going into the 2005s, then you really started to notice that you weren't hearing it as much in the media or, you know, like Tom's Hardware reviewing equipment. You know, geeks, what's it called? I can't remember the name of the website, but just saying that, yes, they've resolved a lot of the issues in terms of solid state drives and the reliability, but a hard disk drive compared to a solid state, I do find a hard disk drive tends to fail slower than a solid state. In many cases, you know, you're working on your solid state one day and the next day it just won't power up anymore. The other downside with a solid state, although they're very reliable and can take shock and or, you know, physical abuse more so than a hard disk drive, data recovery can be a big problem because it is stored just on little chipsets. And for them to read those, in many cases, they literally have to desolder it from the board when they're hooking up their equipment to it and pulling the data off of each chip. Sometimes they can hook off the interface, but Capital Data Recovery in town and John Tunstall from Tunstall and Tunstall Data Recovery, I partner with both of them. You can go ahead and see them, but if I have to do some really sophisticated data recovery for customers, that's who I bring the drives to get the estimates on. They use full white rooms or in the spacesuits, and they're literally doing it like NASA, you know, and trying to get your data that way. So I would still say that if you're going to store data overall, I mean, yes, put it on a solid state and put it away in a vault or a filing cabinet somewhere. It should be good to sit there for many years. But if you're using them every day, I would have to say my personal experience is that the hard disk drive for everyday use of mass storage is way more economical price point wise and just as reliable as the solid state drives. Like a hard disk drive, you know, you could check the mean time before failure rates on these things. But I would say a hard disk drive is probably going to work very well for you for about 8 to 10 years of solid use. After that, it doesn't owe you anything. A solid state drive, again, they degrade over time. They can only write to a block so many times. And reading is much easier on a solid state drive. So if you're doing a lot of data intensive writing to a hard drive, you're going to wear out a solid state drive much faster. And if you read the fine print, in many cases, they have changed the warranties on drives. Like, you know, your Samsung Evo Pro series, you can get them with 10-year warranties. But if you're using the drive in a very large data set intensive way, or lots of writing and reading, they may void their warranty based on your usage. And most people don't know that.
Just going back up, because I think we missed a few questions from, I don't know who this is, Zoom ECE9Z asked, your Lenovo ThinkPad description says 6 gigabit video card. Does that mean it processes 6 gigabits at a time?
No, yeah, that's just the memory size the video card has on board. That's how much capacity it has to be able to, you know, take in whatever the video card needs to process and store in memory. Not that it'll, you know, do 6 gigs at a time. It's just a storage space for it to make the processing of the information more efficient.
And then we missed a question from Stu as well. Years ago, I bought the first ASUS Chromebox as I realized PCs didn't need the bulk they were carrying. Is there a reason the Windows form factor equivalents are priced so high?
Well, the Chromebox is for a Chrome OS, and Windows and Chrome, although you can do pretty much the same thing, are two different animals. And like your Chrome OS, you have to buy everything through the App Store, so it has to be something that is an app for that particular OS, where a Windows machine, again, it's just a little more versatile in the sense of availability of software. There's just less software for the Chrome OS. But most people, like their students, they're wonderful machines, because the Ottawa Carleton District School Board, they're using their Gmail accounts, they're using Google Docs, like all of that the kids are using these days can all be used off of your Chromebox or Chrome OS.
And Timothy asked, was TCER under your banner?
So 2012 Electronic Recycling. Randy Coulter was one of the original owners of Brookliffe and the Trailing Edge, along with Elliot Finkelman. And I worked with both of them at the home computing stores back in the day, if you remember any of those. So I met Randy and Elliot back in 1995. Anyway, Randy started the 2012 Electronics Recycling because he honestly wanted to get out of doing the day in and day out of the computer store, and was passing it along to myself and his son to manage it. And he just wanted to work with recycling and give that benefit to the community as well. So unfortunately, he had to close the 2012 Electronic Recycling several years ago. One, he was getting to that point where he did want to retire, but two, his mother took ill and he went to go take care of her. So he probably would have been around for a few more years, but sometimes family is what's important, right? I still do recycling, by the way. I don't necessarily recycle like directly ourselves. I was doing that with Randy, where he was truly recycling all the equipment on site, breaking it down to the metals and plastics and whatnot, driving them down to various recycle centers down in the Toronto Orillia area. We do offer that if you do have electronic components. It doesn't have to be computer related. It can be like, you know, VCRs, toaster ovens, remote controls, all sorts of things like that. Just not fridges and stoves. One, because fridges and stoves are big, but fridges as well because of the compressors that are in them.
And the freon,
you'd have to get the refrigerant removed, and I'd need the certificate to say that you have. But other electronics, we absolutely recycle. I work with EDI Recycling and Progressive as well. Essentially, They do come by with a truck to my store when I need it. I try and get about 2 skids worth of stuff, so I have, you know, a couple thousand pounds. And for the most part, that usually covers the cost of the pickups. And if I do get any proceeds beyond covering the cost of doing the recycling, I typically donate that to the local food bank.
We also just started this year a program of battery recycling.
Yeah.
We won't do car batteries, but, you know, if you've got a big box of batteries at home, feel free to bring it in.
And again, these are phone batteries, laptop batteries, all your AA, AAA, quadruple A, D, C cells, all your common batteries, just not the bigger ones, like you're saying, for cars. But it's a free program, and we're partnered with.
RBRC.
So many acronyms these days.
I know. and we're also on the Waste Explorer website for the City of Ottawa. So if you are looking for things to recycle, you'll find us under Battery Recycling. Yeah. Do we have another question? Yes.
Get some old drives, TTR. Yeah, they did have a lot of older drives there. Again, I do have some old drives as well. Just really depends on what you're looking for, but I do it on a much smaller scale, and I typically do low-level formats on every drive that we do get that we're allowed to, say, resell, and test them as well. So they might be a slightly higher cost, but if you are looking for some old drives, just email me and let me know, and I can probably dig some up for you. My email is paul@tte.ca, so at the Trailing Edge, and then you can also email sales@tte.ca as well.
So we've got, when Windows 10 reaches end of life, will you be selling any older machines using Linux as the OS? What a great idea.
You know, that's something we should probably put on our website. Again, most corporate level computer equipment, a lot of it runs Linux, no problem. And your consumer stuff too. It's just you tend to run into more issues with chipsets and drivers on the consumer side. But yeah, most of the corporate stuff, notebooks and desktops, can take Linux or various flavors thereof. We should actually put that up on our website and offer that, because we do offer to reload any of our machines that'll take the OS for anybody that wants to use that. I mean, it's a wonderful program to use, and
it is.
Green has a good solid support base from users. So that, and again, that could be a very big plus, but it can also be a downside too, depending on your knowledge level. Okay.
Well. We have a
question there from Zoom ECE9Z at NCF. What is the chipset?
What I was just talking about? Well, unfortunately, there's lots of chipsets. It could be basically chipsets on your motherboard, chipsets on your video card, or your hard drives. So, and depending on what revision of hardware chipset is on that device, that can have different compatibilities or different performance levels.
So. Hello, Elizabeth. It's Elizabeth. So that's great.
Oh, it's Elizabeth. Okay. But in the question though, what is a chipset? I apologize, but what was I talking about? In case I'm being too general on what a chipset is.
Yeah, I think it was in the context of when you were saying that older machines, you end up with problems with drivers for specific chipsets.
Oh, okay, yeah. So I use the word chipset mainly because, you know, I've done a lot of custom builds, and I think of the onboard chipset that's, running and talking to all the various components. So when you load a computer, it's loading drivers for all of these different pieces that are talking to each other. So when you're loading, say, a newer version of an operating system, whoever built that hardware, they might not be supporting it anymore, or they may not have a newer update of the software, so it may not run as well or may not run at all. And that's what I was referring to with all those chipsets.
Okay.
just like Windows 11 right now, they're, like I said, they're, you have to have an 8th generation or higher. But one of the other requirements is something called a Trusted Platform Module 2.0. And that needs to be supported by hardware on your motherboard. So again, if you don't have that, you can't go to Windows 11. I know, I'm just throwing more confusion out there, but if you're confused, come and see us. We'll try and help you.
Mark, we do deal in Mac computers as well. We have
yes.
fixed a fair share of Apple, so don't worry.
Ali Al-Akmar is my senior tech. He's been with me for 10 years plus. He actually started as a co-op student from Bell's Corners High School and then was at Algonquin and now is with me. Lots of good knowledge there over the years he's been with us. But he does a lot. He's the one that mainly does most of the Apple repairs. But we've done many, many, many different all-in-ones. Some of the mini computers, most of the notebooks. The one thing that is more niche-y or something that we don't necessarily work on is the tablets or the phones. And the main reason is usually somebody wants us to work on them because the battery is bulging, which means it's putting pressure on the screens. When you try and remove that screen because the battery is bulging, typically you're breaking the screen. And another dealer that we do pass people along to, if you do need to get your screen changed on your tablet or phone, I would say go to Cellular Pro on Green Bank. Good guy, good prices, and they're close to Hunt Club on Green Bank. I think there's a Metro store in the mall. But yeah, they're good guys. Help them out. Then go see them if you have a cracked screen on your phone or tablet.
We have another question from Natalie. I assume we need to check. Are we over time, by the way, Chris, just to make sure we are over time?
Okay. I'll talk as long as you want or tell me to be quiet.
I think it's fair to say that anybody else has some questions, they can reach out to you directly.
Absolutely.
And, you know, through the members form. If anyone happens to forget paul@tte.ca, they can always reach out to any one of us at the members form, and I'm sure someone will chime in with the email answer to get in touch with you.
Yeah,
that's
to reach out by email, that's for sure. Yeah.
No,
hey,
that's it.
Reach out to us on our Facebook page.
That's a good point.
Or on Twitter or on LinkedIn.
There you go. Yeah.
We're there.
I'm so sorry.
No, it's good. I appreciate it. And look at, I think we'd love to have you back in the future because I can think of many things that we could possibly concentrate on and discuss in more detail. One of the ones that keeps on coming to mind is why would you pick a separate GPU for a computer system? Not asking the answer right now, but, you know, I know it's something that people have considered in the past, and sometimes when they get a laptop and it says, hey, it comes with a GPU, what does that mean in today's world? So, anyways, something to think about. We'll be in touch. Yeah. But before that, I really want to thank Maria and Paul for providing an excellent presentation and once again, helping us all help each other and keeping us informed in the latest and greatest in technology. So I appreciate both of your times today, we look forward to another opportunity.
Absolutely. Really appreciate you having us and listening to me. I hope it was informative, and I'd love to be back to talk about another topic. Absolutely.
Yeah, this was a lot of fun. Thank you.
Thank you. Chris?
Yep. Thanks very much for the presentation, and I'll email you later on, but if we could get a copy of your deck, we'd like to post it onto our website. So either PowerPoint format or PDF, we will eventually PDF it. So if you could send that to either Lawrence or myself, that would be really great. Thanks very much, and thanks very much to everybody for showing up. And with that, I think we'll call the meeting to a close.
Yeah, thank you, everybody. Bye. Had lots of fun. Really appreciate it. Have a good night.